Tokyo Podcast episode number 17.
On today's show, we continue our Japanese language series by talking to a gentleman who speaks over 5 languages. He's here to give us his tips on learning a new language. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Joe. And I wanted to give a quick thank you to everybody who sent me feedback in regards to the video I posted of my trip to Takao-san. A couple weeks ago, I went out to visit Mount Takao. I took my video camera along and I sent that video to everyone who subscribes to Tokyo Podcast. And I wasn't quite sure if everybody would want to see the video or not. Because Tokyo Podcast is obviously an audio show, it's a radio show, I wasn't quite sure how people would react to having a video file sent to the subscriber list. But the response I got from everybody was overwhelmingly positive. Everybody really enjoyed the video, and everybody encouraged me to make more videos. So that's really great. I'm really thank you everyone for the feedback, because I actually enjoy making videos a lot. And Japan is such a fascinating country. I mean, it's a videographer's and photographer's paradise here. The landscape is amazing. As the weather gets warmer, I plan on making more videos and pushing those out to everyone who subscribes to the show. If you missed that video, you have a couple options about how you can see it. Is one, you can just go to iTunes, do a search for Tokyo Podcast, and subscribe to the show. And then that way, the show will automatically get downloaded to your computer. Or you can go to my website at tokyopodcast.com/Mount Takao, and I have the video posted there as well. So a couple ways you can watch it. Go take a look and let me know what you think. We continue our Japanese language series today with Mr. Yushi Shinoda, who speaks over 5 languages fluently and offers tips and study techniques on his very popular YouTube channel called Uncle Polyglot. He's here today to talk about his study techniques for learning languages and what it was like for him growing up learning multiple languages at the same time. If you're studying English or if you're studying Japanese, you know how difficult it can be just to learn one language. Well, Shinoda-san speaks 5 languages. And so we're going to talk to him a little bit later on in the show about what it's like to learn, you know, multiple languages at the same time. Does he ever get mixed up? And what are some suggestions that he offers for those of us who are just studying one language? But before we get to him, we're going to talk about sake with Mr. John Gottner. John is a longtime resident of Japan and is widely recognized as making sake popular in the West. He is the only non-Japanese certified master of sake tasting in the world and has also achieved the very difficult sake expert assessor certification from the Japan National Research Institute of Brewing. He's here to talk about his start into the sake world and his sake professional course that he offers through his website. Hi, John. Welcome to Tokyo Podcast.
Thanks very much, Anthony.
Now, I am relatively new to sake. I really haven't drunk it much at all, but something that I've always been fascinated with and wanted to learn more about. And I stumbled across your website, sakeworld.com, and I was thrilled to see all the information that's on there and the courses that you offer. Can you tell us a little bit, just a brief history of how you kind of got started into the world of sake?
Sure. It's actually something that, rather than me having chosen this path, I think this path chose me. I came to Japan in 1988 as an English teacher with the Ministry of Education on something called the JET program. And I had no particular interest in sake whatsoever when I got here, nor did I expect to stay very long, to tell you the truth. Famous last words, I was 23, 24 years ago.
Right.
And on New Year's Day 1989, I visited someone who introduced me to some good sake. And up until that time, I would walk into a store and see 50, 100 brands on the wall and thinking, you know, what the heck are they getting all worked up about? It all tastes the same, doesn't it?
Right.
And on New Year's Day 1989, someone introduced me to about half a dozen good brands. And I can honestly say my life changed it that day. I found that I was very, very interested in the flavors and the profiles and everything about sake, the culture, the history, how it was produced, all of it. And the more I studied, the more interested I got in it. And I never in a million years thought that I would make it my work by any stretch of the imagination. Right. And I went through the work I was doing and eventually went back to my original discipline, which is electrical engineering. And at one point in time, I believe in 1993, I was drinking with someone who worked at the Japan Times, and I got off on a tangent about sake, and he asked me to write a piece for them. I said, yeah, I could probably tap something out. So I wrote a piece for them, ended up being a 5,000-word piece that went into their weekly magazine.
Wow.
After that, they came to me and asked me to write a column for them, which I did for 8 years. Soon after that column came out, a publisher saw it, someone that worked for Tuttle, and they approached me to write a book about sake for them. And things just proceeded naturally along those lines. Now, once you start writing publicly about something, you can't make it up and you can't repeat yourself. So I had to study a lot about sake. And I ended up getting very involved in the industry, just visiting breweries, going to tastings. And I found that the more involved I got, the more interested I was. And there was just no end to it. At some point in time, I got involved with a handful of brewers promoting sake overseas. And then eventually, I realized that what I would like to do is to give people what I wish I had when I got here. In other words, set up some educational seminars so that people could learn about this stuff while they're living here. At that point in time, I started a series of monthly seminars about sake. And eventually, I realized to make sake really popular around the world, what had to happen was that those that sold it overseas had to no longer be afraid of it. They had to be able to be comfortable selling it. Right. So I then put together all the seminars I had ever done into a comprehensive package, and it was a 3-day seminar with 2 days of brewery visits. It comes out to 5 days. And I offer that now 2 or 3 times a year. I call that the Sake Professional Course. It's a very intense but very thorough, very comprehensive sake educational program. So that's kind of the strange path that I've come along.
What is the people's reaction, in your experience, from overseas to sake? Are they familiar with it? Is it something that they kind of have every now and then when they go to a Japanese restaurant, or do they drink it at home, like wine? What's your experience with that?
Certainly, it varies hugely from place to place and group to group. If you, for example, were to go to New York or Los Angeles or San Francisco or Chicago, where you have a lot of Japanese restaurants, a lot of people that frequent them, a lot of people that eat out in general, I think most people will. Let me correct that. Most people that will enjoy wine, for example, or enjoy finer beverages and finer food will have had some experience with it. Very often, they will have only had hot, bland stuff and had no idea, really, how diverse the world of sake can be.
Right.
Having said that, there's certainly a lot of people that have never had it at all, especially if you get out of the bigger cities and into the inner parts of the United States, at least, and other countries as well. There's a lot of people that have never had it at all.
Right. Does sake hold kind of a historical significance here in Japan? Like, you know, some parts of France has, you know, the vineyards that have been around for hundreds of years. Does sake enjoy that here as well?
Oh, does it enjoy it? I don't know if you could say enjoy it. Does it have it? Absolutely. In other words, sake goes back about 1700 years. And the oldest brewery in Japan right now, and there were before brewers, other brewers before him. But the oldest one now has been brewing continuously for about 860 years.
Wow.
That's a far cry above and beyond a vineyard that's just a couple hundred years old.
Right.
In fact, very few of the 1,200 sake breweries that remain are less than 100 years old.
Has the way they've made sake changed at all in those years, or is it still the same?
Not drastically over the past 1,000 years. The basic process is still the same. I mean, certainly they fine-tuned it. For example, the ability to mill the rice further and further gives you much more aromatic and clean sake.
Right.
And they've only been able to mill it to the degrees that they mill it these days for maybe the past 60 or 70 years.
Right.
So for the centuries before that, it was much fuller and richer. So the process is basically the same. But for example, milling the rice much further takes away fat and protein, which gives you a cleaner fermentation, a lighter, generally more aromatic brew. And that's only been around for about 70 years, even if the underlying process is the same.
Right.
New yeast strains and new rice strains will give you different flavors and aromas as well. And these have really only come into their own in the past few decades as well. But the underlying process has remained, for the most part, unchanged for about 1,000 years. Mm.
And I think that for many people in the West, certainly for myself, I always assumed that sake was drank warm, because that was my experience. And, you know, that's quite contradictory to obviously drinking wine. Is it meant to be drink warm, or can it be drunk cold as well?
No, absolutely. In fact, most premium sake today is better off slightly chilled. And the reason that is most premium sake today has aromatics and delicate flavors that would just be bludgeoned out of existence if you were to warm that product.
Right.
Now, 100 years ago, for example, much more sake on the market was much more suited to warming. Right. And the difference is nothing more than the flavor profiles involved. Richer, earthier, sometimes sweeter flavor profiles will meld together into something enjoyable when gently warmed.
Right.
So there is no right answer as to what temperature to drink sake. I would say that most premium sake, which is known as ginjo, G-I-N-J-O, ginjo sake, right. Most premium ginjo is better off slightly chilled these days. There are exceptions to that. There's exceptions to everything in the sake world. I would also say that long ago, much more sake was enjoyable, gently warm, but that seems to be changing these days. Having said that, I would say about 75% of all the sake in the market is actually not premium. And that corresponds, I think, to anything else. I mean, wine, most wine out there is table wine. Same with beer. Most of it is cheap.
Right.
But most of the sake world, about 75% of the market, is relatively inexpensive non-ginjo sake, which isn't as aromatic. And a lot of that is served warm simply because it is a traditional way to do it. And that's the bread and butter of breweries that make that kind of product. In other words, they can sell that kind of sake for heating to cheap Japanese restaurants all over the country forever. And so there's a need for that. And that's why that continues to exist today.
Right. Okay. So someone who is, say, getting into sake for the first time, and maybe they're in the West and you know they're a little bit unfamiliar with the labels, how would you recommend that they start?
There's three things I can recommend that makes it really easy. Number one, you can make a decision on price and price alone, and 90% of the time you're going to be safe. In other words, if one sake costs, for example, 1,000 yen, and another sake costs 2,000 yen, almost all the time, the 2,000 yen bottle of sake is going to taste significantly better. Let me rephrase that. In the opinion of almost everybody, the more expensive sake will taste better. So sake basically is fairly priced. Right. I don't think you can say that about wine or any other product out there, but right. 90% of the time, sake is fairly priced. So you can make a decision on budget and you'll be safe in making that decision. In other words, the more you pay, the better the sake is going to be. Are there exceptions to that? Absolutely. There's exceptions to everything in the sake world. And on top of that, once your preferences come into play, in other words, if you like sweeter sake and this dry sake is more expensive, you're better off going with less expensive sweet one if you know what you like. But all things being equal, if you have no idea what else to base your decision on, you can make a decision on price and price alone, and 90% of the time you'll be safe. So the first thing is make a decision on price. The second thing is drink something with the word ginjo on the bottle somewhere. Ginjo sake is super premium sake. Ginjo sake is to regular sake what, for example, single malt scotch is to regular scotch, or what 100% agave tequila is to regular tequila. In other words, the same stuff. It's just made with better ingredients and in more exacting ways that's going to give you a better product. Now, there's various subclasses of ginjo. But if the word ginjo is somewhere buried on the label, somewhere in the name of the sake, then you know you're drinking the top 8% of all sake on the market. Mm. So first of all, make a decision by price. Second of all, drink something with the word ginjo on the bottle somewhere. And third of all, you want to drink your sake slightly chilled. If you're going to pay that much money, and if you're going to drink something with the word ginjo on the bottle, you want to enjoy it gently chilled. Mm. Certainly there's exceptions, but these are the most basic rules. If you follow those three rules, it's very easy to get into premium sake very quickly.
I'm just so fascinated with this stuff. It's just amazing that this drink has such a rich history and so much culture attached to it. Can you tell us a little bit more about your sake professional course? If people want to find out more about sake and what do you offer, what can they learn on your course?
Well, my motto for the course is that no sake stone remains left unturned. Basically, the most comprehensive sake education program on the planet. Now, admittedly, it's probably a bit too intense for a regular consumer. I mean, it's designed for professionals, people that want to know absolutely everything about it and learn about it within a week so that they can go sell it. Certainly, it's open to anyone. It's certainly enjoyable. I guess I have about 10 to 20% consumers, and the rest are either working for importers or distributors or restaurants or things like that. But in any event, in a very logically progressive way, I start with the basics of sake, and I progress through every single aspect of sake, how it's made, the grades, rice varieties, yeast varieties, culture, history, the master brewers, regionality in sake, all the ingredients, everything is covered. Now, what's really, I think, unique about this course is that over the course of 3 days, we'll taste about 90 sake. And basically, what I do is talk about a topic, and then we taste sake relevant to that topic. For example, I'll talk about rice varieties, and then we'll taste 10 sake, each made from a different rice. And you'll have several sake where the only thing different is the rice. So you can see the effect of that. Wow. I then do the same thing with yeasts and the various grades, milling rates, the various non-standard or unorthodox brewing methods. So every time we talk about something, we then go taste it afterwards so that people get the intellectual information, but they also taste it and smell it and kind of lock it in that way. Now, when I do this course in the United States, which I do a couple times a year, it ends after 3 days. When we do it in Japan, I then take everyone down to Western Japan, where there's a lot more breweries concentrated, and we visit 4 breweries so they can actually see everything that we've been talking about for 3 days. And of course, each night we go out and have dinner and drink some of the best sake we can get our hands on.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. And is the course in Japan, is it in Japanese or is it in English?
Of course not. It's in English. That's the whole point.
The course is in English here in Japan.
That's correct.
Okay. And when's your next course available in Japan?
Begins in less than 2 weeks on January 23rd. It'll run from the 23rd to the 27th.
And are there availability of that course still?
Currently, there's about 2 seats left. Because of the nature of the course, we move around Japan a lot. It's limited to 20 people.
Okay.
And there's currently 2 seats open.
Okay, great. And if people want to find out more about that, they can visit sakeworld.com with a hyphen in the middle. And I'll post a link to that from tokyopodcast.com. Thanks, John. Thanks for coming on the show. I really enjoyed talking to you and learning a little bit more about the world of sake.
My pleasure, Anthony. Thank you very much.
Have you ever wondered what it would like to speak more than one language? How about 4 or 5 languages? My guest today is Yushi Shinoda-san, and he speaks 6 languages. He has a very popular YouTube channel where he makes videos of himself speaking Japanese, English, French, Mandarin, Cantonese, and Shanghainese. Shinoda-san is here today to give us some suggestions on how we can improve our language learning abilities. Welcome to Tokyo Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Anthony.
Oh, thank you for coming. Now, I am very excited to talk to you today because not that I'm a polyglot or anything myself. I mean, I'm pretty monolingual, but I always enjoy talking to people who speak multiple languages because I find that everybody learns languages differently.
Yeah.
For most of the people, most of the public, learning a language is one of the more difficult things to study. So I always find it interesting that while the general public struggles learning just one other language, there are people like yourself who can speak 5 or 6 languages. And so I'm always fascinated with how that process works. How does someone can learn 5 or 6 languages where everybody else can barely struggle to learn 2. So could you tell us a little bit about your background? You're living in Singapore now, but you're originally from Japan. Is that correct?
That's right. I was born and raised in Japan. I was in Japan up until the age of 12. And then I moved to China, where I lived for 6 years. And then I also used to live in the U.S. and Switzerland and Singapore. So I've been around a lot.
Wow.
Yes.
And when you were moving to all these different countries, mm-hmm. did you have to learn a new language at every new country?
Oh, actually, it's a bit different in the sense that before moving to that particular country, I was doing some preparation in terms of language learning, in the sense that I was learning Chinese for 3 years at the time I moved to China. And then before moving to the US, I have been studying English for quite a bit. And before moving to Switzerland, I was studying French for like 7 years. So yeah, always did a little bit of preparation beforehand, before actually moving there to learn. Because the way I view it is that if I have to start from scratch in a completely new environment, I will have to struggle a lot. And so in order to avoid that, I always did some preparation.
Wow, that's interesting. And you did all this at a very young age?
Yes, yes. I got started. Of course, I had to start from scratch when I first got started. When I was 9 years old in the fourth grade of elementary school, my parents got me started on Chinese and English at the same time. And at the very beginning, I was learning these languages on the radio, on NHK, with the course that they're, with the language course that they are doing, on a daily basis. So, I was, doing this, Eigo Kaiwa and Chugoku Kaiwa, which is, English language program and Chinese language course on NHK, for about 3 years. And then I got really, really fascinated with these languages, especially Chinese, because I thought Chinese was a very beautiful language, the way it sounds and everything. So I really wanted to actually go deeper into studying Chinese and explore some ways, explore if there are any ways to go to China to study. And my father somehow managed to find a boarding school in Shanghai where I can stay and study Chinese. So he decided to send me over to Shanghai when I was in when I was 12 years old, and I got enrolled in middle school, which is a completely local, completely Chinese school, and I stayed there for the duration of 6 years in total.
Wow. What was that like, leaving Japan and going to study in a completely Chinese environment? Did the NHK lessons help? Like, obviously they helped, but when you got there, could you speak fluently?
No, no, not at all, not at all. On the very first day of school, yeah, I had no idea what the teacher was saying,
right?
Because they speak so incredibly fast. But somehow, I think it helped me a lot that I had generally good pronunciation in Chinese, so that whenever I open my mouth to speak Chinese, my classmates would understand me.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Even though I might not necessarily understand what they were talking, I could make myself understand, and that was a big help. And given that I was very young, I was able to basically pick up the language very fast, as compared to other languages that I learned later on.
Right. When you were studying English and Chinese through this NHK program, did you ever get mixed up in your head? Like, how do you study two languages at the same time and not get them all mixed up in your head?
The answer to that question is actually no. I didn't get mixed up between English and Chinese. It really helped because these two languages are actually completely different.
Right.
So, as opposed to, for example, studying English and Spanish and French at the same time, or Spanish, Italian at the same time, which are very similar languages.
Right.
I didn't actually confuse them.
Wow.
Right.
And you were 9 years old, you said, when you started this program, right? So you would have also been studying Japanese, correct? You would have been learning kanji
and
everything. So at 9 years old, you were essentially studying three languages at the same time.
Yes.
Sugoi! I think when I was 9 years old, I could barely speak English.
No, it's not that big of a deal, really. It's not that big of a deal, really. And it's it helped me with my Japanese as well, because, as you know, in Japan, we also use a lot of kanjis.
Right.
And if you study Chinese, then it actually helps me with my kanji in elementary school in Japan as well.
Right.
So my kanji grades were always great when I was in Japan.
What was it like to study English through this NHK program? Like, what were the lessons like? Was it repetition? Were you watching a video
Actually, it's a radio English conversation program. So most of the texts are actually conversation based.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. It comes in the format of a series of stories, little stories. And, it's basically everyday conversation that might take place in the US or in the UK.
Did you lose any of your English ability at all when you were in China?
Yes and no, in the sense that in China, they also offer English lesson. It's actually mandatory to study English. And I was having five hours of English every week.
Wow.
So basically it will be 1 hour per day.
Right.
Right. So it's actually slightly more intensive than the curriculum offered in the Japanese public school system.
Okay. What do you think of the curriculum that's offered in the Japanese school system as far as their English abilities go?
Actually, quantity wise, I think, it's a bit too little, in my own opinion.
Right.
I think they could be offering a bit more so that the pupils in middle school or junior high school, they will have more chance to talk English.
Right.
Right. I think they're not given enough opportunity to actually speak up, which is a pity. Because I'm pretty sure that those Japanese kids, they also want to speak English. It's just that they're not given sufficiently an opportunity to speak.
That's a common complaint, I think, that many Japanese people have. And that's, I think, where they struggle with English is that they learn so much grammar in school, but they have very little opportunity to speak. So their balance of knowledge is quite one-sided.
Definitely.
Here in Japan, there aren't that many opportunities to speak English. I don't know if that's an excuse or not, because I do see a lot of gaijin here, and I think there are opportunities if they look for it, but obviously there's not as many in school as they would like. For yourself, learning six languages, how important was it for you to practice speaking?
It was extremely important. But then again, I grew up in the countryside where you don't see that many gaijin foreigners around.
Right.
So, sometimes, you will have to actually force yourself to talk, by yourself. It's like, you will have to have a lot of monologue sessions,
right,
which I still do, up until today.
Right.
Yeah, when I was, for example, when I was learning English in China, there aren't that many American people around in Shanghai, especially back in the 80s when I was living there.
Right.
So I will basically have to listen to a lot of radio in English, and I have to talk to myself a lot, such that I can, improve my ability to express.
That's very interesting because the Japanese students that I noticed who spoke pretty good English, because almost all of them received the same level of education. They all studied in school.
Right.
And the ones that I noticed that could speak just a little bit better than everybody else were the ones who always took that extra step to study it on their own. Whether they would read an English newspaper every week or watch an English television program or, in your case, just speak to yourself, I did notice that it was quite a large difference in their English speaking abilities between the ones who could communicate in English and the ones who couldn't. You know, Japanese people, when they try to learn a language, they're usually very hesitant about making mistakes.
Yes.
What about your feelings on that?
It's quite natural. And I'm also, how should I say, I'm a very self-conscious person in the way, in the sense that I'm very afraid of making mistakes and having people point them out to me.
Right.
Because I think it's a very embarrassing experience for me. But at the same time, I think it's really a good opportunity to challenge yourself. While I was self-conscious, I still made a point of venturing out. And whenever I see a foreigner around, when I was in Shanghai, I went up to them and spoke in English.
Right, okay.
Yeah, to give me some new challenges.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And when I was able to make myself understood, that was such a pleasurable experience. And I slowly but surely got addicted to that sensation
right.
of being understood. So that helped me a lot, you know, in terms of, you know, building up my confidence and all that.
It is funny that when you are studying a new language,
mm-hmm.
how enjoyable it is when you can communicate with someone in that language in even the most basic of sentences.
Definitely.
You know, when I was living in Thailand, mm-hmm. I would be so happy that I could tell the taxi driver how to get to my apartment. And, you
Definitely.
Know, and something yeah. like that in back in my home country of Canada, I wouldn't mm-hmm. ever think about. But mm. it really is a personal, you know, joy when you're studying a language where you can have even the shortest conversation with someone and you understand, and more importantly, they understand you.
Right.
That's something that if you never take that chance to try to put yourself out there and risk embarrassment, you'll never get mm-hmm. that joy of having that, you know, successful conversation.
Definitely, definitely. And I think that sensation of joy is something that's very addictive. And if you repeat it many, many times, eventually you will get hooked.
Right.
Right. So, yeah, I completely agree with you. I also remember my sensation of joy when I was able to make myself understood in Chinese when I spoke to local people in Shanghai. And I really thought to myself, wow, my Chinese is so good that they can actually understand me without them having to ask me, you know, one more time, what did I say? So... yeah, it's a huge sensation of pleasure.
And the one thing that I have noticed with almost everyone that I've interviewed who's good at learning languages mm-hmm. is a couple things. Is that one, they enjoy learning a new language.
Mm-hmm.
They really gain a lot of pleasure from it. Whereas mm-hmm. I think for some people, it's not, you know, it's something that maybe the company forces them to do or their parents mm. force them to do. So they don't actually enjoy it. So the ones that I noticed that learn new languages quickly, one, they enjoy it. And two is they look for opportunities to use the language in enjoyable situations.
They do. Yes.
For example, yeah. you know, if you like golf,
mm-hmm.
well, then learn English golf. Go to an English golf course and try speaking golf English there, which is kind of the opposite sometimes of how we learn a language. Because if we go to a language school, they teach you these phrases and sentences that right. you may never use in your real life situation.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, I agree with that. It's really important that, you know, not to regard studying as some tedious chore that you have to do.
Right, right.
But always try to make it enjoyable. And in my own case, I love studying English because I enjoy watching Hollywood movies, for example. I think they're so cool. And it's really pleasurable that you can catch a sentence or two during the movie. Right, in English.
And you can understand the idioms mm-hmm. and slang and
definitely,
stuff like
definitely.
That.
It's extremely, extremely pleasurable, when you come across a sentence that you already know and, understand it for the first time, as you hear it being used, in actual movies.
Right, right. What was the difficult thing for you in learning English?
Good question again. For English, I think the pronunciation was very difficult. And for myself, vocabulary was extremely, extremely difficult because, I don't know, I think I struggled more with English vocabulary than Chinese vocabulary because, with Japanese and Chinese, we have a lot of words, vocabulary in common based on the fact that we use kanji. Both in Japan and China. But, the English language is completely, belongs to a completely different language system in the sense that you have to really learn everything, every single word. And, I was struggling quite a bit before I was able to read books and stuff in English. I think I was learning English for like 10 years before I was finally able to pick up a book and read it through without looking up the dictionary.
Wow.
But that takes a lot of patience and exercise.
What kinds of things, exercises were you doing to improve your vocabulary?
Mm-hmm. Mainly I was employing, actually it's a very boring method. I was using a lot of flashcards, when I was memorizing those vocabulary words in English. I was, I think when I was in college, I was going through like 50 flashcards every day. It took me ages to actually, copy them out.
Right.
And, but it was, it really helped. It really helped.
You know, I had a friend in Thailand and what mm-hmm. he did was, you know what a post-it note is? Those little yes. yellow office notes.
Yep.
He, took those and posted them all over his house. So on the refrigerator, he would write the word in refrigerator in Thai and he'd post that on his refrigerator and then on his TV and his bookshelf and everything. So when you walk around his house, he had these post-it notes all over the place with the Thai vocabulary word for that item written on it. And he said, actually, he got so sick and tired of looking at these post-it notes that he memorized it much quicker so he could take it down.
Interesting, interesting. But I think it's a great method because it really, it connects the word with the actual thing.
Right.
Right. So it strengthens the connection. And it's, I think it's quite straightforward.
I think it allows him to see.
Mm-hmm.
And he would speak the word and hear it and everything. So it uses a number of different senses.
Yep.
And also just the annoying factor of having these post-it notes all over your apartment. His goal was to take them down as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. So I think having some kind of goal or reward like that motivates you to learn quicker.
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. Rewarding yourself, it's very important. And, which is what I do, when I am in the process of learning languages. I keep rewarding myself. Let's say, for example, I've been learning Cantonese, for quite some time. And, when I reach a certain level, I reward myself a trip to Hong Kong, for example.
Right.
Yeah.
So you can practice your Cantonese in Hong Kong?
Exactly. And have fun at the same time.
Right, right, right.
Yeah. So it's really, yeah, it's really important. This concept of, you know, rewarding yourself, you know, whenever you do some learning.
Right. So let's switch for a second from English to French. What made you decide to study French?
French is something that I began to study purely out of interest, personal interest, because I've always been fascinated with languages that sounds beautiful. Languages such as Mandarin. And I think English sounds extremely beautiful. Actually, I didn't set out to study French from the beginning. In fact, I got interested in the French language through another language, which is Portuguese.
Oh, okay.
Back in Japan, I was really into Brazilian music.
Right.
Yeah, bossa nova and samba and stuff. And then I began to study the Portuguese language because I thought that, you know, it sounded like the most beautiful language in the world.
Right.
So after about 1 year, I migrated to Singapore from Japan. And in Singapore, there aren't that many textbooks on Portuguese. So even though I really wanted to continue my studies of Portuguese, I couldn't. And I thought to myself, you know, what would be the most similar language linguistic-wise to Portuguese? And I thought that French might be the next choice. And fortunately for me, over in Singapore, there are a lot of French textbooks. So it was actually a natural choice for me. And then I got started in the French language. I began with very, very elementary grammar books. And I also read a lot of children's books because the vocabulary is relatively easy. And slowly but surely, I got hooked in this language. And I would say that French is my favorite language by now.
Favorite because of the way it sounds? Or?
Yeah, the way it sounds. And I've also, like I said, I've also rewarded myself a few trips to Paris.
Right.
When I was doing, and I absolutely love the city.
Right.
It's the most beautiful city in the world.
Yeah.
So, yeah, eventually I began to not only enjoy the French language, but also French culture as well.
Right.
I think
right.
their culture is really cool.
Right.
So, yeah. So slowly but surely, I think French has become my favorite language, even more so than Chinese or English.
You know, you're right. French is such a beautiful language. I used to joke with my French friends that they could be saying anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they could read their utility gas bill, and it yep. just sounds so cool that it just makes you want to learn French. And I've spent some time in France, not in Paris, but in the south of France. And you're right, is that area, that the French country is really, really nice, really, really gorgeous.
It is.
And I wish I could remember some of my high school French when I go back there. Did it help in learning French that you already had learned English, because there's a lot of similar vocabulary and similar words between English and French?
Most definitely. Most definitely. In the same way that it helped me to learn Chinese with the knowledge of Japanese, because we have a lot of things in common. So it helped me a lot vocabulary wise, but the pronunciation was a big, big, big challenge for me. It was so tough, and I struggled a lot, and to the point of hating it even,
right?
Because it was so difficult. And for the first 3 years of my learning, I basically gave up studying the pronunciation because it was so tough, and I focused instead on grammar and vocabulary and conjugation and stuff.
Right. What was the breakthrough that, cause I've heard your French videos and yeah. to my English ear, they sound really, really good.
Oh, and thank you.
I know from my experience in studying French in high school, it is yep. such a difficult language to pronounce. There's all these sounds that come from the back of your throat that we don't have in English, and I'm sure you don't have in Japanese as well.
No.
So how did you overcome that?
It was, like I said, it was extremely, extremely tough. Especially like you mentioned, the French language has this guttural sound where you generate the sounds from deep down the throat.
Right.
And I just couldn't generate that kind of sound in the beginning. And I was always searching and searching and searching. And eventually, I got hold of this children's French textbook. I think they're targeted at kids learning French,
right?
In America or somewhere. And with that particular children's book, which came with an audio CD, the recording was actually done in a very slow and clear manner that even I could actually keep up with the recording.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So actually, I think it really helps to humble yourself and, learn from children's books, even though you might be an adult.
Right. Just to help with the pronunciation. When you were studying French, did you have any French people that you could practice with? Like, how do you know if your pronunciation is getting better?
No, there was actually nobody to assist me. But then again, in the process of learning some other languages like English and Chinese, I think I developed an ear where I can relatively objectively analyze whether I'm doing well or not in terms of pronunciation. In this sense, my pronunciation is purely a product of self-study instead of having somebody correct me.
Would you say that you have kind of an exceptional or unique ability at learning languages?
I don't deny that I have some talent. That's for sure. But then again, I don't think that's something that, that not ordinary people cannot do.
Right.
Excuse me for the double negative, but it's like, how should I say? Language is a language, after all, and it's spoken by everybody.
Right.
So that means that, every Tom, Dick, and Harry can do it, right? Then
right.
You should be able able to do it, you know, if you put your heart into it.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. That's one thing that I've found in talking to many people who can speak multiple languages is that they don't have some kind of special technique or special brain or something. Yes, they are a little bit unique in that they enjoy learning the language and they may have a little bit extra ability to learn it. But for the most part, most of the polyglots that I've interviewed have always said the same thing in that it's just basically hard work, dedication to keep at it, and a real joy in learning whatever language that they're learning.
Mm.
And that's something that anybody can do.
Definitely, definitely. And I think in the case of Japanese people, the issue with them is that many Japanese people are so afraid of being different from the others that I personally had this experience in Japanese junior high school when I was taking an English course with my classmates. Everybody tried to sound in a way that is not too gaijin-like. They will deliberately modify their accent so that, their accent will adapt or blend in with the others. So they will try to say an English sentence with a purely Japanese accent. Because if you try to sound cool and sound American-like, people will, start to take notice and say, hey, is this guy trying to look cool or something? Right? And there is this, I think, this flock mentality, so to speak, among the Japanese is stronger somewhat as compared to some other foreign people.
Right, right.
Yeah, that's the way I think. And for myself, I have one thing that makes me different is that I have never been afraid of being different from when I was very young. Back in my elementary school years, nobody in my class was studying Chinese. There might be some kids who are learning English, but Chinese is such a rare language for a 9-year-old guy to study. Yeah, but I wasn't afraid of being different. and people gossiping about you and stuff like that.
That's something that I think is, I think that's probably the hardest thing for Japanese students to overcome. More so than any grammar technique or pronunciation or anything. In that, the very fact that you're trying to learn another language makes you different. And you have to do things to learn that language that are different than your regular life or your regular pattern.
Definitely.
And if you're trying not to do that, then you're limiting your learning ability.
Yep.
You know, like you mentioned, the students, if they're trying to speak English with a Japanese accent, they're trying to learn and not learn at the same time.
Definitely.
But I think trying to convince Japanese people to embrace the difference, to be different, I think that's the bigger challenge.
Yep, definitely. So like I said, I've told you that I think I have some talent, and my talent is actually that's related to mentality, you know, and the way of thinking instead of my intelligence per se.
Right.
Yeah. It's just that, you need to adopt an attitude that it's okay to be different. You know, you don't have to be the same as the others. And if you adopt this kind of attitude, right, it will make your language learning a whole lot easier.
Wow. That's really amazing. I wish you all the best in your language learning journey. And I hope that, anyone who's listening to this, if you are studying a language, you can learn from Shinoda-san and improve your language ability as well.
Thank you so much, Anthony.
Yeah, no problem. If you want to check out more of his videos, do a search on YouTube for Uncle Polyglot. He has videos in English and French. And can you introduce yourself in French just so the audience can hear your French?
Oh, gosh. Okay. Bonjour tout le monde. Je m'appelle Uncle Polyglot. Ça me fait vraiment plaisir de vous parler aujourd'hui ici à Tokyo Podcast. C'est quelque chose de super cool. Merci.
Merci. Well, it's so good. So yeah, if you want to check out more of his videos, do a search on YouTube for Uncle Polyglot. And thank you, Shinoda-san. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, Anthony, for having me.
Thanks to both my guests for coming on the show today. If you are interested in finding out more about how sake is made, visit John's website at sakeworld.com and look for his sake professional course, which starts on January 23rd and runs through to the 27th. If you want to check out some of the videos that Yushi Shinoda-san has made on YouTube, do a search for Uncle Polyglot, and you will see many of his videos that he's done in English, Chinese, French and Japanese. He talks into a little bit more detail about how he studies each language and what materials he uses. It's very, very interesting stuff. So, and don't worry, I will link to both of those websites from my website at tokyopodcast.com. That's it. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Anthony Joe, and see you next week. Bye-bye. How do you study an accent? Like your English sounds pretty good to me. How do you study a pronunciation?
Mm-hmm. Okay. By simply mimicking, actually. Because I've always liked mimicking people and animals and stuff.
Okay.
I'm pretty good at mimicking animals such as crows and cats. When I talk to them, right, they would actually respond.
What? When you talk to crows and cats?
When I was doing this croaking sound, like a croak does, right? It was quite a scary experience. But when I did it for fun, actually a whole bunch of crows came over and flew over all over me.
Wow.
Yeah, not unlike the movie, the Hitchcock movie, The Birds. It was quite scary, but at the same time, it also validated my conviction that actually I'm pretty good at mimicking sounds. And in the same way, I also, talk to mimic cat sounds, cat meows,
right,
and they also respond to me.
Oh, so you actually speak 8 languages. You can add crow and cat to your list.